This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of The New Yorker and WNYC Studios.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Think a little bit about the family you grew up in. There's probably someone in there that you're a little, I don't know, ashamed of or afraid of. A sister who tells racist jokes, a brother who drinks too much and screams at the kids. An uncle who seems to have a little bit more money than anybody can account for. Every family's got someone. But I'm going to bet your family doesn't hold a candle to Astrid Holleders.
Most of the men that I know from my family are dead. I could name not many people that are still alive that I used to know because they were shot.
Holleder grew up in an Amsterdam neighborhood that's called Jordaan. It's gentrified now with galleries and Airbnbs. But when she grew up, it was big families in narrow apartments and a street life that was pretty unsavory. There was street crime, mobsters, and tax fraud. She grew up all around that stuff. But when Holleder was 17, her family would be at the center of a crime that became international news.
In Europe, the kidnappers of beer millionaire Freddie Heineken today made their first demand, silence from the police, Heineken's family, or else.
Heineken and his chauffeur were abducted last night as Heineken...
35 years later, Astrid Holleder is still living in the aftermath of that terrible crime. When staff writer Patrick Radden-Keefe went to meet her, he was picked up in a car and taken to a secret location. We've altered her voice in this recording because telling her story has put her in great danger. Here's Patrick.
The kidnapping of Alfred Heineken, who everyone called Freddie, the magnate who ran the Heineken Company, one of the richest men in the Netherlands, was news throughout the world. Heineken walked out of his office one cold day, and as he was about to get in his car, masked gunmen pulled up in a minivan, grabbed Heineken and his chauffeur, and drove off.
Freddie Heineken, hij is voorzitter van de raad van bestuur van de brouwerij, en zijn chauffeur zijn vanavond ontvoerd. Rond 7 uur zijn ze in het centrum van Amsterdam door onbekende gemaskerde mannen.
No one was more riveted by this crime than the Holleder family. Astrid actually remembers talking with her brother Willem, who was something of a local hoodlum himself.
I was sitting with him, eating with him, having dinner, and telling him, well, who's going to kidnap Heineken? You must be crazy because this man is a friend of the royal family. He has like so much power. They will not get away from this. And I was telling him that. And he was like, oh, do you really think so? Do you think they can't get away with it? And I'm, yes, sure. Who could be so stupid?
The thing is that their father, Willem Sr., worked for Heineken.
He was driving the trucks with beers on it, like a beer glass of 3 feet high or something. So we grew up with Mr. Heineken. We grew up with the company. He admired him so much. He would do anything for him.
Their whole life was Heineken.
Like everything in our house was drenched with the company. We ate from plates from the company. We had pencils and pens from the company. We had like balloons from the company. We played with the balloons from the company. So we also enjoyed the beer of Mr. Heineken very, very much. My father was an alcoholic, but he was very cruel.
The violence in the neighborhood was nothing compared to what Astrid and her siblings were experiencing at home.
Coming home drunk, drinking all day, all night, and yelling at us, beating us up, beating my mother up. We never knew what to expect because there was no logic. It could just be because I put like my hand on the wrong side of the chair. That would be enough to receive a beating.
There were four of them. Astrid, who was fiercely independent. There was Sonia, who her mother described as a doll. She's very put together. There was their little brother, Erard, the baby of the family. And then there was Willem, the eldest, who, from his teens, started getting involved in the criminal world around him. He did this with his best friend, Cornelius van Hout, who everyone knew as Cor. They were really close. Cor actually started dating their sister, Sonia, when she was in her teens.
Well, Cor was like, he has what I call, and what we all lack in our family, has joie de vivre. When things were bad, he would always see the bright side. Another thing that struck me is that he didn't seem to be afraid of my father. And that was something that I was impressed about.
Astrid admired Cor, and she liked him. And she identified with her brother Willem, the tough guy. She related to him.
I think that if I would have been a boy, then I probably would have been the right hand of my brother. Yes. Because I have the same anger inside me. I have the same aggression inside me. And I was very ambitious. And I think my brother is also very ambitious. And because I'm a girl, you could never take part of anything to anything. So you were just a girl. And I had to look for other opportunities. His criminal career started with robberies. And those were like also spectacular robberies with speedboats and, you know, going through the canals of Amsterdam and then going through the water on the eye, the lake. And there were a huge amount of money that they laid their hands on, like millions.
But the kidnapping of Freddie Heineken was on a whole different level. It was so well executed that for weeks, the police had no idea where to look. Desperate, the Heineken family wound up paying a massive ransom, the equivalent of about $35 million today. Eventually, the police got a tip-off, and they found Heineken and his chauffeur. They were also tipped off that Cor and Wim were behind the operation. But when they went to Cor's house to arrest him, they found Astrid and Sonia there instead. The sisters were dumbfounded. They had no idea.
I never expected him to have done that.
So you had no inkling. You didn't even have any sense at all that your brother, even you knew that he was involved in crime, but you didn't think he would do something like this.
No.
One of Astrid's biggest concerns when the police took her in for questioning was that she was going to miss her German exam. It just didn't compute for her. The idea that her own brother had kidnapped their father's boss. The Heineken kidnapping was kind of an ingenious plot. Cor and Wim had been planning with several associates for more than a year. They built a series of soundproofed cells hidden in a warehouse on the outskirts of Amsterdam. They devised a coded system for communicating with the police and the press. And by the time the police came, they'd already fled the country with millions of dollars in ransom money.
A lot of people commit crimes. I know, you know, it's something that happens. It's part of society. But it's never that close. And with Wim, everybody he has a connection to, he turns around and then he commits a crime towards them. And I think that started with Mr. Heineken.
Willem and Cor weren't at large for long. After a couple of months, they were captured in Paris at an apartment they were staying at in a posh area near the Champs-Élysées.
Het resultaat, Van Hout en Holleder krijgen van de Fransen huisarrest en slijten hun dagen in hotels. Daar ontvangen ze de pers
when,
en zo ziet Nederland voor.
They were arrested. There were so many questions unanswered.
Petter de Vries was a crime reporter for the Telegraph at the time, and he followed the whole thing very closely.
So I was anxious to know what happened, how they prepared everything, how they did it. And so I contacted Cor van Hout. I wanted to write a book inside the kitchen of the criminals from the point of view of the people who did it, the kidnappers.
Wim and Cor were giving interviews. They were stuck in a kind of legal limbo in France, and their fame started to grow. There were these young, cocksure, kind of arrogant guys from the streets of Amsterdam who'd had the nerve to kidnap the richest man in the country. They cut a dashing profile.
A lot of people were surprised that a criminal can also be a person with humor, common sense, and stuff like that.
Pedro de Vries ended up writing this book called Kidnapping Mr. Heineken. It was a huge bestseller. This is the kind of book that people in Amsterdam who don't read books have read this book. Everybody knew the story of Cor and Wim. Cor and Wim were eventually extradited from France to the Netherlands, and they were tried and convicted and sentenced to 11 years in prison. But they ended up serving only 5. And when they got out, they were like celebrity criminals. Not only that, but the authorities had never been able to recover all of the ransom money. So with the help of some of their criminal associates, Wim and Cor had actually invested some of this money while they were in prison.
They bought like real estate in the red light district in Amsterdam. So they bought all kinds of prostitution there. They bought like the gambling halls. They bought Casa Rosso. That's also like a, gives live sexual live shows. The banana bar, it's a bar where women shoot bananas with their private parts. And that's where a lot of tourists come and watch. I mean that's, they bought it, yes. They had apartments, they had beautiful cars, not in their names, of course. It was all in names of other people, but they didn't have to work. It's not that you could see remorse or poverty or whatever. No, it, then the life started. The vacations, the house in Spain, all those kind of things.
Astrid remembers this as a relatively happy time. With their father long since out of the picture, Wim had assumed the role of the family patriarch. Cor and Wim were still partners in crime and best friends. Cor and Sonia had a second child. Astrid had gone to law school. So there was a kind of tentative harmony of the different elements in what was really a crime family.
Our families were always together. My sister had a house and we would all eat there. My brother, me, my other brother, my mother, Cor, you know. So we had one big family. And we thought everything went well.
After university, Astrid had tried to get a job in corporate law. But the Holleder name was notorious. When she went out for job interviews, nobody wanted to hire a Holleder. Wim suggested she meet with some of the criminal defense attorneys he knew. They were excited to talk with her. Being the sister of Willem Holleder had cachet. So she became a criminal lawyer. And it turned out she was really good at it.
I understood my clients. I understood the mothers. I understood the sisters that were arrested too, while they even didn't even know why. I understood the children. So to me, criminal law was, yeah, it was me.
As her career took off, Wim began to confide in Astrid. He would tell her about things he was doing, tell her about his fears. She wasn't formally his lawyer, but she did act as a kind of legal advisor, an informal sounding board.
So you, during this time, you had gone to law school. You had become quite a high-powered criminal attorney with connections throughout the city and the country. You're obviously a very formidable, smart personality. And yet you talk about kind of being under the thumb of your brother during this time. Looking back, like, how do you make sense of that?
First of all, I was his little sister. And in that sense, he was always older than I was. So he was always trying to be and remind me of the fact that he was older and I had to respect him. I was trying to give him the legal advice that would prohibit him from undertaking certain actions. Like when he was planning to shoot a rocket into somebody's house, I have to remind him that I think about him only, not about the victim he's planning to make. So that's why I advise him that he shouldn't do that, because if he would have used a rocket, that it would have been an enemy of the state. So I would advise him, don't do that, you know? But it was difficult. You don't want anybody to get hurt, but you also have to be careful not to get hurt yourself.
And it was all too easy to get hurt. One day in 1996, an assassin opened fire at Kaur as he sat in his car with his family, right outside their home.
They were sitting in the car, and then a guy walked up to the car and shot through the window, and he hit Kaur. And my sister, she opened the door, rolled out of the car, and grabbed my nephew, who was sitting in the back singing a song at that time, and took him into the house. And Kaur was hit several times, but he survived.
Initially, there was just panic and confusion. When Kaur got out of the hospital, he and the family fled the country and went into hiding in a farmhouse in the woods in France. Vim promised he'd get to the bottom of things. After some investigation, he came back and he said, I figured out who wants you dead. It's these two rival gangsters. They want to kill you, and they say that unless you pay them a huge sum of money, they're going to. This seemed believable. What was strange about it to Kaur was that Vim said, I think you should just pay them. Kaur himself was no stranger to extortion, but generally he was the guy doing the extorting. So in this instance, he said, I'm not going to be extorted. I'm not going to pay the money. And this was the beginning of a real wedge between the two friends.
And then it all started. Vim was trying to force me to tell him where Kaur was. And that went on for a long period. And that was really awful because it terrorized us.
Vim wouldn't let it go. He'd ask Astrid and Sonia for information about where Kaur was hiding, and they were reluctant to tell him. Over a period of time, an awful suspicion began to occur to the sisters. What if it hadn't been these gangsters who had ordered the killing?
Then in the end, there was a second attempt, and Kaur did survive again. And then there was a third time, and that was final.
After Kaur was killed, the family gathered together, and Vim came, and he comforted his sisters. But by this point, they were pretty certain that he was the man responsible for Kaur's death.
We were all three of us sitting on the couch, and he was in the middle, and he was grabbing us by the shoulders and pulling us towards him. And I'm like looking at my sister, and my sister's looking at me, knowing that this is all fake. And knowing you have to just undergo this, because if you do otherwise, you would accuse him. And if you would accuse him, then he would probably kill us too. So there was not much of a choice.
Just as Astrid was coming to realize what her brother was capable of, the rest of the country was falling for him. Vim started writing a column for a local newspaper. He was featured on a hip-hop single called Villam Is Back.
Hey, Lange, zeg jij het even.
Ik heb wat dingetjes gedaan, ja, je hebt het vastgelezen. 21 jaren van mijn leven vastgezeten. En het komt door niets spreken. Ik ben een ouderwets. Ik haal mijn rug rechter dan die mooie oude west.
He even appeared on a national talk show called College Tour.
U bedankt voor het kijken thuis. En Willem Holleder voor uw aanwezigheid hier in deze zaal. Dank u wel.
Bedankt.
Dank u wel.
People would see Willem around Amsterdam riding his scooter, and he became this well-known, kind of iconic figure. They started referring to him in the Dutch press as the cuddly criminal. People would come up to him on the street and ask for selfies. Meanwhile, his associates in the underworld started dying one by one. And with Kaur dead, Astrid and Sonia were terrified for their children. Astrid's daughter, Miljuschka, and Sonia's children, Francis and Richie.
It's always a question, is he going to do anything to the kids or not? We were two women with children and had to, yeah, survive. So that's what we did. You feel hypocrite. From the day on that happened, it was a feeling as if I betrayed Kaur, betrayed myself, because I just acted the way he wanted, not having the guts to go to the police or anything. So, that was the start of feeling dirty.
No one was arrested in connection with Kaur's death. Vim, for his part, was suspected pretty widely of involvement in a great many murders, but he was never charged. He could seem almost above the law, immune, zipping around on his scooter and palling around with local celebrities. But privately, he was becoming more erratic. Eventually, crime journalist Petter de Vries found himself in Vim's sights. Petter's popular book about the Heineken kidnapping, which was a big bestseller, had been picked up by an American production company.
That is the way the game is played.
You know how big this thing is.
He's insane. Or he's smart.
But before the movie came out, Hollader turned on him.
He said, I don't want to have my name mentioned in this picture. And at that time, he came to my house in the evening at 10 o'clock. And then the doorbell rang. And when I looked out of the window, I saw, hey, that's Willem Hollader. And I said to my wife, I don't think this is okay. He was on his motorbike. He had his helmet on. He had a big leather jacket on, gloves, big shoes. And he is quite an impressive guy, even without these clothes. And I immediately saw that he was fucked up. And he was, when I opened the door and I said, hey, Willem, he started yelling at me. And at that time, I was thinking, oh, in 30 seconds, I will be lying on the ground fighting for my life.
But Petter de Vries is a bit of a tough guy himself, and he's a seasoned crime reporter. So he managed to keep his wits about him.
I said, Willem, calm down. Let's just talk. What's the problem? And now he finally calmed down a little bit and he seemed to leave. And about three times he also returned to me, standing again very close to me. And do I have to do it right now? You know what is going to happen. You can call the police, but it won't help you. And but finally, after three times, he went away, and that was it.
Petter did call the police. He filed a police report. But in the meantime, Astrid had started talking to the authorities too.
I couldn't live on with the thought that he would kill again. So that's when I turned on him. The only thing we would have left if we wouldn't go to police was take the rights into our own hand and shoot him. And I must say that would have been the best solution for him and for me. But my daughter didn't want me to. My daughter didn't want to have a mother, a killer for a mother.
She started to tell the police some of what she knew. But the whole process filled her with terror. What if Vim found out? What if she had to testify in court, but there wasn't enough evidence to send him away? She was a criminal defense attorney, remember. She knew what kind of evidence she would need. So she decided to wear a wire.
That in itself was an adventure, because at one point I thought I had a really good one and I had it stuck between my the front of my bra. At one point, we were talking, and I felt that it was sliding. So I felt it fall down, and I was with him. So if it would fall on the ground, I mean, he would have noticed that. He would kill me immediately. So there were times that I was really, really afraid, and I kept on being afraid.
Astrid eventually compiled hundreds of hours of recordings. And she persuaded Sonia to record conversations with Vim also. The first time I heard these recordings, they gave me a shiver. You listen to them and you can hear, just in the tone of his voice, the kind of figure this guy was in his family. He was a figure of terror.
Allemaal tegen me aan, door jou! Omdat ze denken dat ik erachter zit, kankeroer.
Willem was finally arrested in 2014 and charged with involvement in half a dozen murders, including the murder of Cor van Hout more than a decade earlier. Her brother is in police custody now, but Astrid isn't safe. In 2016, a gang member being held in the same prison told authorities that Willem had tried to hire him to murder Astrid, Sonja, and Petter de Vries.
What will you do in the admittedly very slim chance that he's not convicted?
Then he would go after me, and I would go after him. I'm not going to sit around and wait till he is killing everybody.
Astrid shuttles around the city in armored vehicles. She wears disguises, and she lives in a series of safe houses. When I went to see her, I would be told to wait by a particular canal in Amsterdam, and a driver would show up, then take me to an undisclosed location. I never knew where I was going. It was never to her apartment.
I'm living in places that are furnished. It's always being in somebody else's house. So that's different. I'm like 52, but I don't really have a place of my own.
When she testifies in Vim's trial, she sits behind a screen. She doesn't want anybody to see her. But also, the prosecutors don't want her to be able to see Vim. So she's behind the screen, yet her voice fills the courtroom. And the two of them bicker and argue. They shout at each other at times. It's incredibly tense. If Willem is convicted, he'll probably be held in a maximum security prison until he dies. But even then, Astrid won't feel safe. I asked her why, and she said that if he gets a life sentence, her brother will have nothing to think about for the rest of his life but revenge. Like Willem, Astrid has become a celebrity in the Netherlands. She wrote a book called Judas about how she turned him in. Think about that title. She doesn't see herself as a hero for stopping this murder spree. She sees herself as Willem's betrayer.
I think it's awful what I do to him because he will be in prison for life. So thinking about that, being the person that sends him away for life, that's an agony every day. If I think about the moment he must have heard that I was the one who testified against him, that must have been such a shock. And later on, he did say in court how it felt for him to hear about us, especially me, testifying against him. Yeah.
Watching the trial, what struck me the most was that despite the incredibly raw conflict between these two siblings, as brother and sister, they still share a powerful bond. That having grown up in this abusive environment, Astrid feels, despite it all, incredibly connected with her brother.
I keep thinking about all the factors of our childhood. I'm like, well, it could have been me, you know, if I would have been a boy. It could have been me.
If you could talk to your brother, if it were just the two of you today, now, together, not in the courtroom, what would you say to him?
Oh. Whoa. That I still love him in spite of everything. That I wish I could take him home. That he could be a brother to me. And, that I could take him home.
Astrid Holleder, speaking with New Yorker staff writer Patrick Radden-Keefe. Patrick's profile is called Crime Family, and you can find it at newyorker.com. Astrid's book Judas was just published in the U.S. You're listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Now, I'm not really a beach guy. I don't need the salt water up my nose, the sand all up in, you know, everywhere. If I'm going to get a sunburn, if it's absolutely necessary to be out on the water, I think I'd rather go fishing. But a couple of years ago, I went to the shore with a friend and a colleague, the great journalist and lifelong surfer, William Finnegan. Bill had just published a memoir called Barbarian Days, and it later won the first Pulitzer Prize, I'm pretty sure, ever given to a book about surfing. So it was suggested to me that I meet up with William Finnegan on the water. And by the way, David, you're going to have a great surfboard just for you, and Bill's going to give you a lesson. Fantastic idea, right? Did we mention that you're going to go at the crack of dawn on a Sunday?
Look at this. I mean, nobody can surf, but look at the waves. Wow.
I'm sitting out on the beach with the great Bill Finnegan.
Oh,
see that?
Oh.
Let's try that again. That was quite a wipeout. I'm sitting out at the Atlantic.
Look at that stance. Wow.
I'm David Remnick, and I'm here with my friend and colleague, Bill Finnegan, who's written an astonishing book called Barbarian Days. And we're sitting out here in the Rockaways at the Atlantic, watching a lot of people fall in the water as they try to surf.
There are probably more than 100 people in the water. And the waves are kind of nice. They're small and quick. And one of the odd things about this crowd is that there are no clumps of people where the waves are concentrating, because nobody out can read the water at all. Nobody's reading the waves. And you actually read the waves first before you ride them. I read these as pretty good, with a couple of good spots to take off.
The water looks so nice, I want to go dive in.
So what we're going to do is we're going to get in the water.
Yeah.
And we're going to attempt to stand on a board.
You're going to catch some waves.
Yeah.
You might be well advised to stay on your belly the first couple.
Okay. That's what I tend to do when I surf.
It's low tide, so it's going to be a little crunchy, a little quick. Let's go west. Yeah.
Let's go where it's like maximally dangerous. And you began this adventure in life as a really young kid in Hawaii as a way to do what? As a way to get out of the house?
I grew up playing around in the ocean in Southern California. At a certain point, at the age of 10, I really admired surfers and how beautiful what they did seemed and how cool. This is in the early, mid-60s.
How long did it take you? How many times did it take you before you could get up on a board and surf a wave?
I think the first wave I caught, I stood up and rode for a long time. But I was a small kid.
The first time you went surfing?
Yeah, but I was a small kid on a big board. I spent a lot of time in the water body surfing.
You're just trying to make me feel better.
I spent a lot of time in the water body surfing. I could read waves.
Right.
I've been reading them for years, and that's the crucial thing.
And why did it become an obsession? It wasn't just, you know, everybody when they're kids, they play playground basketball or they collect model airplanes or they do what they do. Surfing for you has never been that. How did that start and why?
Well, surfing is quite different from other sports, and it's not just me, it's for lots and lots of people this happens. It takes a tremendous amount of time to get even halfway decent. I mean, you need to put in basically years during which you have nothing else to do. In other words, you need to be a kid. And once you learn, the pleasure of it is so intense.
What is it? What's the pleasure of it?
Well, riding a wave well, it feels like such an achievement because you know how far you've had to come to do it. There's that. Some waves I caught in Fiji in the 70s off an uninhabited island. A friend and I camped there. We'd kind of heard about a wave, and then we'd seen this wave with binoculars, and it was an absolutely incredible wave. A long, 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 a 300-yard long left over a very shallow coral reef, just going on and on and on, and you're not getting obliterated, not falling
off. And in
off.
Real time, how long does the experience last?
It's probably 10 or 15 seconds, but it feels like forever. I mean, you're in that moment where you are braced for impact, you're about to dive off, and you don't dive off, and you don't dive off.
What are you seeing? What's in front of your eyes?
Well, you're looking down the line. What's the wave going to do? What's the wave going to do? And at a certain point, when you realize that the wave is just going to hold you that deep in the barrel and just fire you like a cannon down this reef, you are free to actually look back deeper into the tube. You're free to look up at the wave that's breaking over your head. You're inside, and you're looking at daylight and sky ahead, and that's where you're headed.
Is it roaring or quiet?
It's noisy. I mean, at a certain point in the barrel, people say it gets quiet, and I think I've felt that, but I don't know why it should be true, because the wave's breaking full force all around you.
All right.
First,
let's
put your leash on. Put it back down.
I have to put a leash on?
Yeah.
This is the third most terrifying thing I've ever done in my life.
So, the two things I told you, it's actually important to remember now.
Board straight.
Straight. Board straight. And second thing I didn't get to finish telling you.
Okay.
Never get your board between you and the wave.
Oh, good you told me that.
You. Yes. It's to the side or behind you.
Good
to the
tip.
Side or behind you. Never between you and
excellent
the wave.
Excellent tip.
Third
so,
thing.
So the board should always be to your side.
Side or behind you, anywhere but except in front of you. Because it will hit
okay.
you quickly.
Okay, great.
And the third thing, and this is for after you fall off.
Yeah.
This could happen.
Which could possibly happen, yeah.
Get a good breath if you can before you fall off.
Like, uh-huh.
Fill your lungs. And when you
fall in,
it's not real deep, it's not a lot of water, but nonetheless, go as deep as you can, go to the bottom, whatever. And then hold your breath and stay down there a little while.
Why?
Because the board is bumping around, you don't want to get hit. And then when you come up, and this is the most important single thing,
yeah.
come up with your arms over your head.
So it's not
in front of your face, so you
face.
Don't get hit by your board.
And you think that I'm going to remember all this
yes.
in a moment of crisis?
No, I mean people never do until they get hit a couple times. But
I don't want to get hit any time.
So that's why I think
right.
you will remember.
All right, let's go.
Okay, let's walk this way a little bit. Because
right.
the current's going that way. We don't want to end up on those rocks.
Okay.
Pretty little waves.
You know, Bill, I've read your book a couple of times, and I cannot help but thinking this guy has had more fun in about 3 weeks of life than I've had in a lifetime. There are different ways of living lives. You know, that Milan Kundera book, Lightness and Heaviness, the heaviness
uh-huh.
of responsibility, and there's the lightness of living outside, trying to live away from that.
Yeah.
And you've done both. You know, as a reporter, you've been in the middle of the worst circumstances all around the world. And then you do this. How does one treat the other?
It's a good description. I mean, I have this sort of bipolar life, and the North Pole of irresponsibility is surfing, you know, dropping everything. It's nature worship. And you have to be ready, if you're going to surf, to like ditch all engagements and flee your desk and make all kinds of bogus excuses to editors while you chase the waves when they're there.
But you did it for years at a time.
Yeah, I don't know. If you've got the time and money, you just go. And I just went. You know, like dog whistle orders from on high. And I went to the South Seas, Australia, Southeast Asia, Africa, looking for waves.
And nothing was tugging you back? Parents, friends, money, whatever it is, nothing was dragging you back to...
Well, ambition was. I mean, I felt like, you know, everybody was getting on with life except me. I'm laying here with malaria in Sumatra. You know, what's, you know, why am I doing this? My parents got fed up with it. After about two or maybe 2.5 years, they just showed up in Cape Town where I was teaching high school. Enough was enough. You know, I mean, they'd had like a few phone calls for me in 2.5 years. It's not that I didn't remember them, but
you never get bored of it.
Bored with waves?
Yeah.
Not when the waves are good.
And so there's always the lure of the possibility of the waves.
Right, and the waves are usually not good, and you spend a huge amount of time chasing good, uncrowded waves.
All right, here we go.
It's fairly cold.
I didn't exactly grow up in a beach family.
Go ahead and lay down on it. I'll push you out. Good. Good. Go ahead and lay down.
Get on it?
Yep.
My usual experience of the ocean in New York City is when I would go with my grandmother after visiting my great-grandmother to Coney Island, and she would just yell at me and say, "Watch out for the syringes."
You're okay. Don't paddle. Don't paddle. Don't paddle.
What is it in your personality that makes surfing part of you?
I have been surfing so long that it's probably...
It is your personality.
...formed my personality to some extent. And anyway, all kinds of personalities surf, you know.
Right, I was going to say, you're not Mr. Laid Back. I mean, it's not like some cartoon of a surfer. And as a writer and as a reporter, you couldn't be more ferocious and aggressive in your own way.
I think I'm the same person surfing and reporting. I'm fairly intense in the water. I really want to surf. I take some chances. I've had lots and lots of arguments with the guys I surf with. No, we shouldn't paddle out here. I'm paddling out, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of all of a piece.
So you're the guy, when I go out reporting in some place, you're the guy who says, no, we're going to the next checkpoint.
Yeah, okay. I fear so.
Okay, fair enough. Tell me about danger. What's the catalog of your injuries?
Wow, I'm talking about danger. I'm watching people crash into each other out here who just
starting to get more crowded,
what
isn't
they're
it?
Doing. Yes, and people not hanging onto their boards. So the main danger is
starting to look like the Belt Parkway on the ocean.
Yes, it is. So the main danger is other people's surfboards, I'd say. With me, I mean, yeah, I have lots of little injuries, of concussions, broken nose, you know, broken this and that, but...
What do you mean, broken this and that?
I don't know. My ankles are a mess. It seems like everything that's wrong with me is from surfing, but most of it's long term. It's my eyes are messed up from the glare. I've got these pterygia in both eyes. My ears are really messed up from cold water. I've had 3 operations. My skin is a mess. I'm always having this basal cell carcinoma dug out, and I hope it remains only like that.
Have you ever been terrified?
Yes.
Where?
In Hawaii, in Madeira.
What's the terrifying bit?
For me, the worst moments have been in really big waves. Last year in Hawaii, I did something stupid. I was on too small a board in big waves at a place called Makaha in Hawaii. And I got frustrated because I was on a small board, hard to catch waves. So I moved in. I sat too far in. I sat in a really dangerous spot, and I paid the price. I got held down for a very long time by a couple of big waves. And I've actually taken a solemn vow not to do anything that stupid again.
Do you want your daughter to surf?
No.
She's how old now?
13.
And you've never kind of done with her what you just did with me?
I've pushed her into little waves.
Is she suitably terrified?
Not bad. I mean, no, I even took her out to her mother's distress before she could swim. I took her out in Costa Rica and rode some waves.
Whoa. You took her out surfing before she could swim?
It was totally safe. she had one of those little things around her. Little floaty things. And she was, I had a death grip on her leg. She was not going to fall off. The waves were small. We were on a big board. But it was taken ill by my wife and others.
Can't imagine why.
Yeah. But then she and I, in Hawaii one time, were out on a giant tandem board, like, riding together. We've done that a few times, you know, ridden together just on our bellies, me and back. And I made a mistake, and we had a really big board, like an 11-foot board.
She got smacked.
And had her dad land on her. from a height, and then hold her under for a little while his legs were tied up by a leash, and it was generally pretty rough and traumatic, and she hasn't surfed since, I don't think.
Get ready to slide back a little bit. You did a great job of staying under after you ate it.
I'm really good at failure.
I mean, you were in no danger because your board was outside of you. But okay. In principle, you gotta just...
You're gonna let me know when there's a wave coming, right?
Yeah.
I'm trying to be more careful. Always make sure I get back to shore. That's the main thing. Yeah.
Jesus Christ! Now you have to stand up on the thing. I think I'm hooked. I'm ready to go to Tahiti or wherever.
This book is a memoir, and it uses surfing as a vehicle, as a way of living. And when you look back on all the time you've spent in the water and thinking about surfing, it seems to me like it's like physical chess in a way. It's meaningful and meaningless at the same time, right?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, it's the most useless thing you could possibly do. It's just a monomaniacal pastime, and really doesn't resemble sport. There's nobody keeping score. You'd rather do it alone, usually, although there's a performance aspect.
You want to be seen?
Yes, you want to be seen. You want to do it well. You want to do it stylishly. That's important.
And it has to do with masculinity?
Not necessarily. Some women surf beautifully, but it's...
I meant your own masculinity.
Well, it's certainly, especially in bigger waves, more challenging waves, it's a continual proving ground, yes.
When do you stop?
I have no plans to stop. I do know guys who surf into their 80s, obviously on bigger boards and gentler waves, and they
on lakes.
Try to find some wave to grow old. Some way to grow old gracefully.
I mean, to watch Bill do it, even on a small wave out in Far Rockaway, and nobody else is getting up on their boards for more than a half a second, and Bill at age 60-something, just rides the thing in with ease all the way in. That's pretty amazing. There he goes. Oh my God.
William Finnegan's memoir, Barbarian Days, won the Pulitzer Prize. In a minute, we'll travel up the shore a couple of hundred miles to another famous beach spot. But instead of surfers, this one's got pilgrims. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from the New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs, because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
I'm David Remnick. The actress Parker Posey has been in so many great movies, Dazed and Confused, Clock Watchers, The House of Yes, Best in Show, my favorite, A Mighty Wind, and now she's written a memoir. Our fearless entertainment reporter Michael Shulman went to spend a little time with Parker Posey not long ago, and in fact, he got a little more time than he bargained for.
Oh my God. Did you lock the door? Okay.
Are we seriously locked out here?
Parker Posey next week on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
have you ever boosted someone over a wall?
Kristen Rupanian has published exactly one story in The New Yorker, but it was a gigantic blockbuster. It was called Cat Person. It's about an online relationship that leads to a date that goes horribly wrong. It landed in the midst of the Me Too movement, and Cat Person didn't just touch a nerve, it grabbed the nerve and pulled. And then Rupanian quickly found herself not only in the midst of controversy, but with a considerable book deal. Rupanian comes from Plymouth, Massachusetts, and if that name rings a bell, and it should, it's where the Pilgrims landed. Generations of tourists and school kids have been visiting Plymouth Plantation, the living history museum where reenactors practice 17th century crafts and they keep livestock and try to dodge obnoxious teenagers from the 21st century, like Kristen Rupanian.
Oh, there's Ethan.
This place was a staple of my childhood, but not necessarily in the same way that it was for people who came in just to go on the tour and learn from the actors. I had friends who, as teenagers, did work here. I would come here on school trips, and I would kind of sneak in is the most dramatic way of putting it, but wander around when I was a teenager. My favorite thing to do when I was a kid, and we would come into the main village and talk to the historical reenactors, was to try and trick them. It was like an endless game, if you grew up in Plymouth, to see if you could get them to say something that would reveal that they were not, in fact, from the 1600s. And we never succeeded. I mean, they have an encyclopedic amount of knowledge, and they will not crack, no matter how hard a 12-year-old tries to get them. So now we're heading down into Plymouth Plantation, into the village, so we're gonna see that and poke around and see if we can trick in any pilgrims into acknowledging they know what an airplane is.
And then we spent about another month or so at Cape Cod, about 5 weeks, trying to figure out where we should...
This is, I guess, important to note. In the village, they play actual characters. So it's the Alden family, the Standish family, the Winslow family, representing the actual people there. When I was probably 10, I participated in... I want to call it the Pilgrim's Progress. I'm not sure if that's exactly right, but it was essentially a parade where I was a small child and I had a historical identity. I was a young boy, and what I knew about myself was that I was a troublemaker who eventually ran away and joined for a brief period the Wampanoags and then came back and was hanged. So that was a vivid, vivid moment for me, and I walked proudly down the streets pretending to be that young man. Let's see, maybe in here it looks like a bunch of people are leaving. I always feel a little shy talking to them.
So if you want to think of it this way, this is a bed chamber.
Hi. So could you tell us a little bit about yourself? What's your name? What are you up to right now?
Oh, right now I'm mostly just, I've come in from the garden, so I'm just resting at the moment, but deciding what to cook. Yeah.
Do you have kids?
Any girls?
Children.
yes, yeah. Yeah, 5 in total, but only 2 that are living here right now. I've got 2 sons and a stepson that are still in England.
Can I ask you a question? Do you know what this is?
Does it belong to you?
Yes.
Oh, then it don't matter to me.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So long as you know what it is, okay. then it don't mind me.
Cool. That's all. All right, let's go there. Bye, it was really nice to meet you.
You also.
I showed her a cell phone. So I felt very much like a 12-year-old doing that.
This is like a really peaceful section where you can feed goats.
Yeah. So now we're walking down a path. There's a very distinct smell to the area around here that I think is a mix of campfire smoke, the animals, manure, and then the ocean is right here too. So yeah, the smell of this air brings back a lot of memories for me. And it's beautiful. Chipmunk. Chipmunk just ran adorably across our path.
Wampanoag people drink water and tea daily, every day.
Okay, so this is the Wampanoag home site, and what they do here is they try to convey what it was like for the Wampanoag at the time when the pilgrims arrived and slightly before.
You're welcome, you guys have a good day.
There's what looks like a grass dome style house over there, and then a few, I would call them lean-tos. They're made out of sticks and looks like dried grass.
So the spit is pine.
So there's two women, staff, who are weaving something, it looks like weaving a bag, and roasting some fish over a fire. And they're very knowledgeable about all the kind of little details of life in terms of the materials that were used, the food that they used, the process. Do you want to hear what they're saying?
So for these you can use a dip net, but you had specialized tools for fishing for both the river and the ocean. You had hook, line, and sinker.
They're wearing traditional Wampanoag clothes and shoes, and they're sitting on some skins. That is a vivid sense memory I have too from being a kid and coming here and seeing the skins for the first time and being both fascinated and kind of heartbroken and repelled. My mother bought me a rabbit skin, I think, at one of the stores here, and I loved it because it was so soft, but felt endlessly guilty about it. One thing I remember is that while the pilgrims pretend to be from the time that they're meant to represent, the Wampanoag just talk to you fairly straightforwardly about their lives, while at the same time teaching the people who visit some sort of basic things about hunting and gathering and home building and things like that. The older I got, the more complicated I understood that it was. It's not until you leave home, right, that you start thinking about where did the place that I come from shape me, and it occurred to me how funny it was that I had come from a place that is so obsessed with its own history and has such a specific narrative about how this history relates to the history of the country as a whole. I think the goal is to try and give a version of the country's history that is sort of touristic enough that it draws people and that people come and want to have a nice day, but that maybe gives you just enough that you might start picking back at it and asking harder questions. And I feel like in that sense, like, it did work for me in terms of shaping the way that I think about history as stories, right? Like, not everybody thinks about it like that. Like, you might grow up thinking that history is just a set of facts, and I think they do you can't grow up here and sneak into the village and try and trick historical reenactors into telling you the truth without getting that everybody's telling you a story, you know?
Fiction writer Kristen Rupanian at Plymouth Plantation, the living history museum in Plymouth, Massachusetts. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, and that's it for today. I want to thank you for joining us. If you enjoy the show, you can be sure that you'll never miss an episode if you subscribe to our podcast. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Avi Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, Sarah Nix, Michael E. Rao, Stephen Valentino, and Richard Yeh, with help from Trent Williamson, Michelle Moses, Emily Mann, and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.